Good morning and welcome to the Sports Polygamy Podcast. It's Thursday, the 17th of January, 2013, and I'm Eric George. I am joined once again by my main lover, Kirk Dalziel. How are you, Kirk?
I'm tired, Eric. I actually had to work today, so it's been a big day for me.
A shock to the system, perhaps.
Yeah, please feel sorry for me.
I'm just impressed that you've managed to stay out of the dole queue for this long, so pats on the back all around.
Oh, I'm doing my best to get back in there, but you know, it's only $30 a day. I'm getting paid more than that to do nothing now, so.
And there's no Brenda the security guard at the dole agency, so.
Exactly. If she moves to Centrelink, I'm gone.
She's the greatest asset your business has. So we had a pretty awesome weekend of NFL last weekend. Potentially the best I think I've seen, to be honest. There are other sports that we want to touch on later, a bit of tennis, a bit of cricket, but I thought we'd start here, Kirk, because it was freaking awesome.
That was great. I got screwed twice, though, in two of those games with under a minute to go with my picks leading. They suddenly forgot how to defend, but that was terribly exciting stuff. I only managed to get to see the Saturday games because work required me to turn up on Monday. So just watching those two were great.
Yep. And the Sunday games were similarly excellent. But yeah, we might as well start. Let's do this conference by conference, actually, because it's probably the best way to build up to this week's games. But probably the most high profile of the games was the Broncos losing to the Ravens at home. Obviously, you have the whole storyline of Manning trying to kind of regain his, you know, top spot in the league, and Ray Lewis's last chance to win a ring. Again, he's already got one, but win another ring with the Ravens. Did you see that photo of Manning hanging around for an hour and a half after the game to congratulate Ray Lewis in the locker rooms?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, it was. Peter King wrote a really great article about it. He said he was standing in the room at the time, and they talked for 5 minutes. And he said Manning looked heartbroken, but he hung around for ages just to congratulate Ray Lewis on a great career. Just the photo of the two of them standing together, for me, encapsulated so much of what I love about American football, because you just have these two gigantic figures of the game that mean so much to their franchises and so much to the league, and have so much built up around them because they're so important to their respective parts of their team. So to have the two of them in their suits, not in the playing armor, just kind of enjoying each other's company as great players of the game, was a pretty awesome moment and a great gesture, I thought.
Yeah, it's cool. At least he was gracious in defeat, because he got screwed.
Well, yeah, he did get screwed by his own team. The one point you could make is that Manning's had a bit of practice at getting gracious at these playoff defeats. He's now got a 9-11 postseason record. But I have been critical of Manning having some letdowns in the playoffs in the past. I didn't think this was his best game, but by no means did the Broncos lose this game to the Ravens because of him.
Oh, hell no. Well, the big play, obviously, was Jacoby Jones catching a 70-yarder with 30 seconds left. How safety lets somebody get that deep on what I assume was a borderline prevent defense or a cover four or something like that blows my mind.
They ran Tampa 2. Which is okay. I mean,
that's too deep.
Yeah, exactly. With the third man up the middle, it's almost three deep. If I was them, I don't understand how you don't just run some prevent defense. They had no timeouts, so even if they throw the ball down the field, their best chance was to you know, spike the ball and get one more playoff. So it was just bizarre. And the truth is that even before that, the first half ended in similar fashion, where Champ Bailey got continually abused.
Good.
Joe Flacco in this game had a great game. He is the best deep passer of the ball in the league, in my opinion. Throwing outside of the hash marks, essentially throwing towards the sidelines, when he threw to the right in this game, Flacco went 6 for 7 for 156 yards and 2 touchdowns. When he threw to the left side, he went 2 for 6 for 15 yards and no touchdowns. So it was pretty clear by the end where he was going. We saw it all game. And the fact that the Broncos were unable to make any kind of adjustments and understand what was going to happen. I mean, it was obvious to a spectator. It really makes you question Jack Del Rio's ability to manage the defense.
It wasn't clever stuff because they were poor old Champ was just getting pounded, and he wasn't getting any help from anybody. But you're right. Everybody knew where the pass was going except Denver, it seemed. Even all the fans, I'm sure, had figured it out by then. But the look on the guy's face, oh, as the ball was coming down, he had the look of, I got it, and then, oh, crap, I don't got it.
Yeah.
And it sailed over his head.
In fairness, this does illustrate, I think, another great element about the sport is that you can draw up the play, you can have the right scheme, you can prepare as much as you want, but it still comes down to execution and players making plays at the end of the day. It's not just chess. There are humans out on the field, and sometimes they make mistakes that decide games.
Yeah, exactly. This you still can't take the human element and human error out of it. And especially Peyton Manning, that was as soon as I saw him scramble out of the pocket in overtime, I was thinking, you better not throw this. And to come back across with his linguine arm, maybe 25-year-old Peyton Manning could have stuffed that one in there, but he should have thrown that ball away and just punted it and hoped his defense could stop him one more time.
Yeah, shades of Brett Favre a couple of years ago in the championship game against the Saints when he was playing for the Vikings. Similarly disappointing. It was a mixed game. Like, as I thought Manning played better than Flacco in this game, although most people who are paid to write about football seem to disagree with me on that point. He seemed to struggle throwing down the field. Lombardi on the BS report suggested that he was hurt and seemed to be struggling to get a good grip on the ball. But there were other things as well that I respect Manning for normally that he didn't seem to do, like the fact that he ran the exact same snap cadence for the entire game. It was just hurry, hurry when he was doing his, you know, play call, play call, play call, hurry, hurry, then on one, snap the ball. And if I can tell that from a television halfway around the world, you can't tell me that Ray Lewis and some of the savviest defensive players in the league aren't going to key into that pretty early and really ramp up their pass rush a lot.
It's not going to help you if they know your snap count, that's for sure. They're going to really start stuffing you. It was such an odd game. It was just really strange.
And where was the hurry up? Where was the hurry? Where were the passes over the middle? All the things we knew the Broncos had to do, you know, leaving aside the defensive failures, obviously the special teams were amazing for them, but even on offense, you know, we were talking about the things that the Broncos could do to abuse the Ravens, and they never seemed to go to it at all.
Yeah, where were the constant passing across the middle just targeting Ray Lewis because he's not that great laterally anymore? This was a good choke, a good gag.
Yeah, I'm starting to move on from that word. I think it's just too graphic. I'm not. It's too brutal. But look, at the same time, full credit to the Ravens. They came fired up. They, you know, obviously this whole Ray Lewis storyline has legs and is really giving them something to build a deep playoff run around. And they had a fantastic defensive game plan. I mean, just forcing the Broncos to constantly take the checkdowns all game. They spent a lot of time in the nickel, you know, trying to get them to audible down to runs to pretty average running backs. They came with a very effective game plan, and they scored a lot of points as well. I mean, the fact that they were able to stick with the Broncos in a shootout was impressive.
It was indeed. No Sean Moreno going down early certainly didn't help them at all, although Ronnie Hillman came in and gave it a fairly good crack. But their running game just couldn't get going, and then you're right, all they had to do was then stand off. And every time they did try to run it, their linebackers would come in and stuff everybody. And then I don't know if it was just too cold for Peyton or what. He had those gloves on, which might have made it hard to throw. But something, you're right, didn't seem 100% with Peyton. Although he did laser a couple.
Yeah, he looks good at times. I mean, some of the touchdown passes he threw were vintage Manning. Just great fade routes to the right. They were beautiful, throwing into a tight window. But it's, you know, although Hillman tried, just the truth is that once Moreno went out, they had some really big issues with the pass protection from their halfbacks. They kept making the wrong reads. I think it was Hillman ran into his own lineman at one point.
Hillman only weighs about 120 pounds. I mean, he's a tiny little dude. He's not a run blocker for sure. He's no shell.
No. So, yeah, disappointing, but at the same time, this is what the playoffs are all about, a bit of an upset. In the other AFC game, probably as expected, the Patriots went out there and controlled the game pretty effectively against the Texans. The Texans made it a little bit closer towards the end, but the Patriots had already put the game plan away at that point and seemed to be just on cruise control. It was impressive from the Patriots, the fact that they lost a couple of, you know, core offensive players early in Woodhead and Gronkowski, and it didn't seem to really affect them all. After about halfway through the fourth quarter, they hit their stride offensively and they looked pretty efficient.
Yeah, I'd be pretty worried if I had to come up against this team next week. That was a vintage Tom Brady performance. 344 yards, 3 touchdowns, no interceptions, and he only got sacked once.
The thing is, when they looked good early on, Brady seemed to be really locked in on Welker. He tried to get it to...
Oh, boy, was he ever.
He just was forcing the pass into the tightest windows. And then as soon as he started, they started doing some interesting things as well, where they put Hernandez in the backfield. They lined Vereen up at wide receiver. They went to the hurry up. They passed the ball around to four different targets constantly. They ran the run up the middle. They ran to the outside. As soon as Belichick suddenly, you know, puts it into top gear and uses all the offensive options they have, defenses look clueless in how to stop that. And I think that is still the key for the Patriots, is offensive diversity.
Indeed, and Stephen Ridley was good enough as well to keep Houston honest, and that they had to respect the run because he was going at 5.5 yards a carry. They didn't run the ball all that often, but when they were, he was getting decent yards. So you couldn't just sit back in coverage and wait for Brady to throw it into you.
Yeah, I do worry. Obviously, I'm a Patriots fan, about the rematch with the Ravens. The Ravens do have a lot of momentum. They're not going to be afraid to come into New England. The one thing that gives me hope with all of this is the fact that I went and had a look at, in this millennium, since the year 2000, there's been 10 games where teams have had a playoff overtime win. Obviously, the Ravens game went to double overtime. And these teams then went into a divisional match or into a conference match. I ignored overtime wins in conference matches because you got 2 weeks before the Super Bowl. In those 10 games, one of them was actually between two teams coming off overtime games. So there was 11 teams involved, and the teams went 2-9 after an overtime win. So it's clearly a difficult situation for them to be in. The Ravens doubly so, because they had to play at altitude, across country. Now they're coming over to play New England, that likes to play up-tempo offense. There is a hope there, I think, that if New England can keep the pace high, they'll really wear out a tired Ravens defense in the second half.
Oh, they're going to mess them up. I don't see them recovering. Baltimore's such an old team anyway. I don't know if they can handle a late overtime, a lot of travel, altitude.
And that was a long game as well.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, even without the overtimes, like, it was slow.
That took a lot. That'll take a lot out of them. Whereas the Patriots had it pretty easy in the end, so they'll be nice and fresh. They didn't have to go anywhere. They're still at home. So if we're doing it, Eric, if we're doing the win probability, I say 78% to the New England Patriots.
Yeah, I'm probably going to check it down a little bit less than that, purely because of the impact of losing Gronkowski, who certainly is out for the season now. I don't think it's as bad as people painted, but he's still a huge target for the Patriots in key downs. So we'll wait and see. I'd say the Patriots just slightly less than 70% favorites in this game.
All right, that's up to you.
All right, let's switch it over to the other conference, to the NFC. We'll start with the game you did see, which was Colin Kaepernick's coming out party, as he took a big poop all over the Green Bay Packers defense for 4 quarters. In one of the most absurd offensive outputs I've ever seen.
This was just crushing. He was completely dominant. I was a little concerned when he threw that early pick six, and I thought, here we go. Here goes first playoff experience. He'll choke and go down. And then he decided to run for 181 rushing yards.
It was nuts, which is the most I think a quarterback has ever rushed in a playoff game or not. What happened to Clay Matthews in this game? He was a myth. He didn't even draw double coverage on most of those plays. Joe Staley, playing hurt, managed to handle him himself. I mean, in fairness, Clay Matthews is coming off an injury, but the Packers got no edge discipline whatsoever. The outside pass rush wasn't there. So Kaepernick was just able to run that same read option play over and over and over again, and speed killed the Packers.
There was a great moment there where they actually showed Kaepernick completely fooling Clay Matthews, and Clay Matthews ran around in circles, literally in circles, trying to figure out what the hell was going on. So he was just torching everybody, and it was a hell of a performance, and quite scary, and it makes Harbaugh look like a bit of a genius now.
Yep, it does. I was very critical of the move when he made it in the middle of the season. I'm prepared to admit at this point that it was definitely the right move, because there's no way Alex Smith does that. It's nuts. There are a few things that you have to consider going into this next matchup with the Falcons, which we'll move on to a second. Kaepernick's been a little bit shakier away from home than he has been at home, but it's just everything about that team. Frank Gore ran the ball with some menacing aggression in that game. And when you combine that sheer size that he brings with the speed that Kaepernick brings to the team, with the size of the receivers in Davis and Crabtree. Crabtree's just having an explosive offseason. It's a super-powered offense, which is almost overshadowing the best defense that's left in the playoffs.
This is a scary team.
Yep.
This is a very scary team. They're an offensive beast at the moment. And their line as well, their offensive line is just manhandling people. So it's giving plenty of space for everyone to move. Good downfield blocking when Kaepernick does get out. They're completely dominant on both sides of the ball. So that...
Well, I think the thing that that separates somebody like Kaepernick to somebody like RG3, maybe less so RG3, but definitely Luck and Wilson, is Kaepernick's run plays seem to be designed runs. So they get much more depth to them. He's not, you know, improvising at the end of a play. He's just taking off straight away. So there's huge lanes to run through. This isn't a scramble. It's a quarterback rush.
Yeah, well, it's a read option. So I mean, he's going to watch what the outside man's doing. And if the outside man crashes in, he just takes off around the edge. But he's big. He's a big, strong guy. But also, in comparison to RG3, he slides. He gets the hell out of the way. He doesn't take hits. So if he's only going to get 4 yards, he'll take 4 yards.
Well, and Harbaugh was very clever in managing him as well. I mean, we didn't really get a good look at Kaepernick at all last year. He backed up behind a pretty effective game manager in Alex Smith. So you have to imagine that had a bit of an impact on his ability to, you know, have some better situational awareness now that he's starting.
I think so. He was brought up in a system that wasn't set for the run at all. So he had to first become a pocket passer to sit in with a strategy. And he looked a little bit at odds when he came in and filled in bits and pieces. He was scrambling all over the joint, didn't quite know what the hell was going on. But once once he got it there full time and they changed it specifically, tailored it to his offensive ability, he's been great.
The other thing I have to say about San Francisco is their defense is awesome. Like,
oh, they're killers. Absolute killers.
Patrick Willis is probably my favorite defensive player in the league. Sorry, Vince Wilfork. Oh, I really like Vince Wilfork as well, I guess. But he's just so big and so fast and so mean. Not a rough guy, not a headhunter, but just imposing his will on the game. And that the defensive line is great, obviously, with Smith times two. But their linebackers have got such pace and size. It really changes the way their oppositions play the game.
I agree. They just run straight over the top of people. But they've got it on the line. They've got good corners and good linebackers. I mean, they've got the whole package. There isn't really a noticeable weakness in there, which is scarce. But Patrick Willis, he blows people up.
Yep. Did you see that naked photo of him in ESPN the magazine when they do their body issue?
Is that the one with the guns?
No, that was Harrison.
Well, he was jacked. I imagine he would be enormous.
Yeah, it's imposing. I'll send it to you after the podcast. It's special. Anyway, this doesn't paint a pretty picture for Atlanta, who did very well to get over their playoff hump against Seattle. It's just a game of two halves for them, that performance they put up against Seattle. In the first half, they were displayed an aggression and a ferocity that we haven't seen from them all year. They ran the ball with such will. They really went and won the point of contact again and again and again with both Rodgers and Turner. And then in their passing game, they came up against, you know, these very aggressive big cornerbacks and secondary. And they weren't going for open routes. They were going for coverage guys and just kind of posting up on these defensive players and beating them physically, which was totally not what I thought Atlanta were going to do at all. But they dominated that first half.
They did, but I still don't trust them, Erica, but they blew 28 points.
Yep. They did. The thing was, they stopped being aggressive. When they were aggressive in the first half, when they were going for it, it was hard work. I mean, it was a slog. They had to convert a lot of long third downs. But they were passing, they were going hard at it. As soon as they got cold and as soon as they got scared and as soon as they put their playbook away, then Seattle roared back into it. So I think it kind of tells you that Atlanta just need to keep their foot and the pedal to the floor through four quarters. Otherwise, they got no chance.
Yeah, well, look, they were 33 seconds away from losing. So Seattle blew this one big time. they worked together to screw up those last 30-odd seconds. I just don't trust them. They didn't really... They had a really easy schedule during the season, and then they had home ground advantage with a 28-point lead, and probably should have lost in the end. I just don't think they're going to get it done.
So what about the whole West Coast team traveling to the East Coast factor, Kirk? It is something a lot of people believe in, especially in playoffs.
You play to win the game, Eric. You play to win the game. I don't think that's going to be an issue.
So I'm sure you've got a number here.
55% to San Francisco.
55%?
55%.
You're more confident that New England's going to win than San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Okay, that's interesting.
When it comes to the Patriots, Eric.
Yeah.
See, I've had too many years of being a Bills fan and getting screwed by New England that I just assume that they're God.
Well, I'll take that. I'm liable to agree. I think I'll go higher than you, actually. I think I'll peg San Francisco at about 65. I think this all hinges on Kaepernick. If he can do that again, it's all over.
The whole lot hinges on him if he has a night off the board. But then, once again, they do have the option of going back to Smith if they're down by 10 at halftime or something. Or
I can't see it.
But I can't see Smith getting it back from coming from behind. He's not a behind a come-from-behind player.
Yeah, and I think the way Harbaugh runs that team and the way he's all about giving players confidence, I think he's, you know, breakdown or breakthrough with Kaepernick for that game.
Mm.
Anyway.
Fine, I'd love to see another performance like that. That was exhilarating.
Yeah, it would be really, really exciting to see a Patriots-Niners Super Bowl as well. The game they played this year was fantastic. Brady would have a chance to break another one of Montana's records against the 49ers, you know, the team that he grew up playing against. It'd be great.
But Eric, what about the Harbaugh brothers playing each other in the
Super Bowl? Fuck that.
You fuck couldn't that. Handle that intensity on each sideline?
You know, the thing that does scare me the most here, Kirk, and I will take credit for having said this before Barnwell wrote it in his which Super Bowl winning team are you? The Ravens really are this year's version of the New York Giants. They had an average regular season. They've got a quarterback who's just caught fire in the postseason. They've got a good running game. They've got a good pass rush. They're coming in with all this crazy playoff momentum. It's scary.
You must be terrified.
Yep. Something crazy is going to happen. Torrey Smith's going to catch it with his butt cheeks or something to win the game.
He'll probably catch it in his grill. It'll just stick in his helmet.
Oh, and yeah, that's the other thing. Ray Lewis has stolen Jason Pierre-Paul's crazy Transformers face mask.
Oh, good God.
He's got that crazy 10 million piece grill on now, which, you know, the samurai thing or whatever Pierre-Paul called it.
Yeah.
Not good. Not good. Anyway, that's enough American football, Kirk. Let's move on to the tennis, which is underway, obviously. As we record, Stoza has just been knocked out, joining Hewitt and a bunch of other Australians who haven't really progressed deep into this tournament, which means we are left with the great white hope of tennis in Australia, Kirk. The rejuvenated Bernard Tomic.
Yeah, my favourite player, huh?
Well, you're sort of Australian, so you have to like him.
Hey, I'm a citizen. What the hell do you want? No, I don't have to like him. I don't like this kid at all. He's been an arrogant jerk the whole time he's ever been in tennis. Been calling people. Who the hell did he think he was saying that Federer has to make it to the third round before they have a playoff? Who says he's getting to the third round?
Yeah, I thought that was an incredibly stupid answer. I watched that. I mean, as an aside, why the fuck are we watching a Bernard Tomic press conference rather than the live actual tennis that's happening? They cut away from a game to show Bernard Tomic boring answering questions. Anyway, we'll talk about Channel 7 later. Tomic, someone asks him, you know, what does it feel like that you have to go up against Federer? All you say at that point is, Roger Federer is a great player. He's been a stalwart of the game. I love playing against him. I look forward to the opportunity. Not, well, you know, we'll wait and see what happens.
But my big problem with him is he's just a punk. He's a little kid that's had success in a small pond, and now he's in the big pond and hasn't quite realized that he's no longer the big fish. Yes, he won some junior tournaments, but great. The span of age groups you have there are between sort of 15 and 18. He's now somewhere between 18 and probably 33. The talent pool is so much bigger. There's so much more experience. He plays a really weird game plan of let's just hit the ball back until the other guy makes a mistake, which is fine if the guy's 25 and above, but you start getting into the top 10 players, Murray's just going to towel you all day, every day, because you're going to just keep trying to lob the ball back, not power you out of the game.
Yeah, I agree. And he's done some weird things. I mean, having a public spat with Pat Rafter strange. I don't know how you're going to expect to win that PR war with Australia's most beloved tennis player.
Yeah, and you know what Pat Rafter has? Majors.
Yeah. I think.
You know what Djokovic has? One ATP win.
Yeah. But that's his breakthrough, Kirk. That's the beginning of it all. This all, for me, still boils down to the US Open last year where, you know, he supposedly tanked against Roddick. Then in the press conference afterwards, somebody asked him about it, despite the fact that I think it was McEnroe, but I can't be sure. One of the tennis greats who was commentating asked him about it. He kind of admitted to it. This reporter brought it up to him in the press conference, and he freaked out at him. He said, "What's your name? Who are you?" The guy gave his name. "Who do you work for?" "Reuters." "Okay, I'll remember you." It's like, who the fuck cares? You're Bernard Tomic. This Reuters reporter isn't going to be heartbroken that he doesn't get the exclusive with you. Just settle down.
But he also admitted to going 85% in a match that he lost in the first round of some tournament. I mean, and then he's surprised that he doesn't get into the Australian team. Yes, he may be. You know who was ranked above him? I don't even know how to say the guy's name. Matsevich? He's an Australian tennis player. He was ranked above him. Yeah. I've never heard of that guy. Why am I hearing so much about Tomic?
You know who we could be talking about? Maybe Samantha Stosur, maybe the current Australian tennis player who, although she had struggled here, has won majors, is, you know, in the top 10 in the world, is our most successful tennis player, gets no press coverage whatsoever.
Oh, no, she gets press coverage, Eric, about how much she sucks.
Yes.
That's all you ever hear in the
news. If she put on a bikini, she'd get press coverage in Australia.
Well, no, yeah. Is it because she's a woman? I have no idea. Like, I don't understand what it is. She's in the top 10 in the world in her given sport. Which is supposedly the most equal of any sport in the world because everyone gets paid the same, et cetera, play on the same tour, play together every... Why is she not getting more positive press other than when she won the major? But up until then and after then, she just gets sassed.
She's a myth. It's a shame. And we'll get onto the whole fact that we've decided to resurrect his image, but what about the fact that, you know, I think some fault of this does rest with the Australian media. We've invested so much time in telling Tomic that he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, giving him all this money at a young age, and basically turning him into an overhyped playboy. And then we freak out when, oh my God, he's an overhyped playboy and he's a brat.
Well, that's essentially what the article on Grantland I read today was talking about, is that he's always been told that he's great.
Yeah.
And that he's been given everything he wants. He's in Monaco driving Ferraris. Why wouldn't he think he's awesome?
We're basically doing what England's been doing to its tennis players for the last 30 years and smothering them with expectations every time they look half decent.
And then you just assassinate them when they don't come through.
Yes. So there's his out. But all that said, why the hell have we decided all of a sudden? This was even before he won. Was it Sydney, his first ATP win? Before even any of that had happened, you know, ABC, newspapers, everybody writing big articles about how Bernard Tomic has turned his life around and is going to come back. Why don't we wait until he's actually done something, until he demonstrates some more maturity than we've seen from him yet, and he's, you know, have some achievements to rest his laurels on before we crown him the best?
Let's wait till we get the clay court season going again and watch him stink it up over there. But you're right, but it all stemmed from this win over Djokovic in a match that meant nothing while Djokovic had jet lag. I mean, why would Djokovic care about the Hopman Cup?
Yeah. Yeah.
He just came over for a bit of a hit out. He loses Tomic. Eh, who cares? You know what he's going to do? Probably get to the semis of the Australian Open.
Probably win.
Or probably win it. But I mean, so why would he care? Then all of a sudden, Australia hypes it up to be the greatest victory on Australian soil in the history of tennis.
Yeah. Well, we've been starved for success. It does kind of reek of desperation a little bit. Let's move on, Kirk, before we get too steamed up. Or I guess we already are. But what about the tennis itself? Have you been enjoying it so far?
I have.
Yep.
I have been enjoying it. I still haven't looked up the result of the Monfils match last night.
I enjoyed it.
Did your boy get up?
He got up.
Oh, he beat Dogo Popolov.
I put it on mute. The Channel 7 insists on putting brain-dead French people on to comment. Why is it that Australians get Australians to commentate Australian players and French people to commentate French players, and that's it? Why does it stop there?
I have no idea. Don't get me started on Jim Courier, but let's stick to the tennis before we start bitching about Channel 7. Your boy Monfils, love him. He's still there. He's so charismatic, so energetic, so exciting, and he pretty much is made of rubber.
Yeah, absolutely. He does have some kind of genetic disease that means he's grown in funny directions, according to my girlfriend. But he's fantastic, and he is totally exciting. He's always a crowd favorite. He's coming back from an injury plague season last year. I just like the fact that in a sport kind of, plagued by some cookie cutter players, he's so drastically different. He seems to confuse his opponent a lot of the time just because they can't prepare for what he's going to do, because I don't think he knows what he's going to do half the time until he hits the ball.
No, and sometimes it can be just downfall, and that's why I never became a real dominant player, but it's terribly exciting to watch, and every time I get kind of excited when I see him. I really wanted to watch him 1 year, but everyone made me go and watch Tomic instead. But
I've seen him live.
I'm so great. Jealous.
I did give him a come on.
But the tennis has been great. I mean, it's always a bit of a blowout early, especially in the women's draw. And the top men have done it pretty easy so far, so it's all going as you'd expect. Baghdatis had a pretty tough one the other night, but it's good. I love it, and Australia embraces it, and everyone goes, and they have huge crowds, and the crowds are usually pretty respectful, except for the people that insist on chanting every time a point is scored.
Yeah, and there's always the race riot.
And there'll be a race riot at some point. What is it, the Cypriots and the Serbians or something? That'll be fun.
Yep, always good.
But it's good fun. I mean, the crowds are excited and everyone's happy to have it there, so I think it's great.
Yeah, it is fun. I'm going on Sunday. I'm looking forward to it. It's always a really good event to attend. There's a good kind of gala of atmosphere to it.
You doing the outside courts or are you getting in the main arena?
High sense, baby. Shaded seat.
Who are you watching?
Oh, I don't know. Potentially Sharapova, potentially Serena if she makes it that far. No one too exciting in the men, but, we'll wait and see. I think one of the Spanish men, not Nadal, one of the other guys I think I might be able to see as well.
Ferrer would be good.
Yeah, maybe Ferrer. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it's too far out to really tell. But yeah, I enjoy the tennis equally, or probably not as much as you anymore. You know what I found interesting? I sat down. I was down at Lawn on the weekend. I got the paper out. And I was reading, trying to get hyped up. I did not know half of the women in the top 10, honestly. Like, I try to watch the finals and all the Grand Slams and every year and keep going. Who the fuck are these people?
You know what I do, Eric? I create a random name generator that just grabs every letter from the alphabet, jumbles them together and spits it out, and you get a generic Russian name, and I assume that person's in the top 10.
It's probably fair. They're probably going to be pretty smoking as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But no, it chops and changes so much in the women's, you have no idea what's going on.
It is a problem. I'd say it's a problem. You need that long-term success to build rivalry and build interest.
Yeah, it's a lack of identity in there, I think.
I like Serena. I think she's great. I'll watch her any day.
I like Venus. They're good fun. But other than that, I don't know who else I'd watch in the top 10. Not that I even know who's in the top 10.
Yeah. Okay, good. We've covered the tennis. We'll touch back in next week once we know a little bit more. Once I've been, I can do a sunburnt podcast. What about cricket, Kirk? It's something that we haven't really touched on at all this summer. So you want to weigh in at this point after having watched a fair bit of the action so far?
No, it's been a great summer, except for when I got stiffed going to watch third day of the Boxing Day test, and it was over in 2 hours. That was $60 well spent. But look, the big controversy of the whole thing has been this rotation policy, which I think is brilliant. I think it's a great idea, especially for your bowlers, who are the most likely to get injured because it's the most physically demanding position and task on a cricket field. The issue I have is that it's been perpetrated throughout the public by the Channel 9 commentators, who have an average age of about 60, I imagine. So a lot of them still played in an era when smoking was a dumb thing in the changing rooms, and everyone was fine with that. So they're not exactly the experts to be commenting on modern science and modern research as to how you should control your players. There is this philosophy of the best player has to play. But what's the point in having the best player play for only 2 years if they then disintegrate and can't play for the next eight?
Yeah.
You want to get these young guys and bring them through. Think about how many young guys have completely shattered. Stark had problems with his feet and his back. Remember that guy Pattinson that used to be awesome about 6 months ago? Where the hell is he? He's gone. There was another kid in South Africa whose name I've completely forgotten 2 years ago, tore the place up. He's gone as well because he's got stress fractures and all. They insist on getting these 18-year-old guys in and wanting to hammer them into the ground because the fans want to see them. Well, tough shit. I'd rather see James Pattinson bowl for 12 years than four.
So can you just tell me, you know significantly more about cricket than I do, why has this only become an issue recently? You can't tell me that they were, resting the great cricket bowling lineups that we had 10 years ago all the time.
No, but people don't like change. I actually read a...
No, but why is this necessary now and not then?
Because people are idiots, Eric. A perfect example that I was going to do an article on, but I'm too bloody busy, was baseball, and they were talking about the effect on pitch counts with their young pitchers and how many lasted 2 or 3 years and they never... The attrition rate, as they called it, was enormous because they'd get these guys in and make them pitch 150 pitches a game. And they've weaseled that down now to sort of you don't usually go over 100. And what they're noticing is that the longevity of pitchers' careers are a hell of a lot longer than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, no, I think that all makes sense. But I still don't understand what we didn't rest McGrath and Lee, did we?
No, we didn't. But Lee also got injured a lot.
McGrath didn't. I mean, why does this? I'm curious as to why this has become a necessity recently. Why has everyone just started breaking all of a sudden?
Well, it's not. What has it been happening all of a sudden though, Eric? I mean, the thing is, you can't just look at one or two players and say, "Oh, well, Glenn McGrath didn't break."
Yeah, but fair enough.
So had a very casual action, but you got to look at guys like Tomo, look at guys like Tate, Craig McDermott, Pattinson now, Mitchell Johnson's had issues. Guys just start breaking down if you bowl them too much.
Yep.
And you've got to find that equilibrium of the equilibrium of not enough and too much. You've got to find that middle point there. I mean, there is no doubt that Siddle shouldn't have bowled in the next test match after he almost destroyed himself.
In Adelaide.
Yeah, he needs a break. There is no question that Mitchell Stark shouldn't bowl as much as somebody like Bird who's 26 or 27. He just shouldn't bowl as much because his body's not as rigid or as strong as a 26-year-old man. And when you're exerting 4 to 7 times your body weight through your back at 20 years old, you shouldn't do it all that regularly.
Yep. I think that those are all fair and valid points. You know, my polygamists come back at this point, Kirk, to agree with you. You know who else uses a rotation policy? The All Blacks.
How's that work out for them?
Yeah, I think it's done pretty damn well. If it's good enough for them, it's good enough for the Australian cricket team.
What the rotation policy does is that it creates depth.
Yep.
So you don't go to the Ashes with two guys who have never played or haven't played much cricket before and then suddenly realise, shit, these guys stink, but we're stuck with them like they did with Tate. Took him over there and, this guy will be brilliant. Got over there and got hammered. Then went, crap, maybe he's not that good.
It also means that we won't retire a couple of players and then, you know, which will lead to the destruction of Australian test cricket at the top level for 10 years.
Well, that's exactly the problem. The Hussey leaves, who fills the gap? Ponting leaves, who fills the gap? We haven't rotated these players through enough. Batting, the attrition rate and injury rate is significantly lower, so I can understand them not resting them as much. But the bowlers, you got to rotate them through there. What the hell? Why else do you think pitching staffs in baseball are enormous?
Yeah.
They don't have two guys that pitch or four guys that pitch. They've got massive pitching staffs because they realize how detrimental the action is on the shoulder. So you give them plenty of rest.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree. I think it's an interesting point. I think you really, this just boils down to people are idiots, right?
Well, it does, but also the people that are expressing their opinions were never brought up in an era where there was sports science. I mean, Jesus Christ, you think Merv Hughes is going to get a game today? Ian Healy can shut his trap. Merv is not playing for Australia today because he'd be called a fat idiot with a great moustache. But he was over. He wouldn't even cut it.
Yeah.
Name the last player of that size that has played for Australia.
I can name one who played for New Zealand.
Why? He's not even playing for New Zealand anymore. than it just doesn't happen anymore. It's a professional error, and you're getting a lot of comment from people that were barely in the – and a lot of them never even played one-day cricket.
Yeah.
2020s involved, or the Indian Premier League. I mean, these guys are playing 11 months of the year.
This is the problem with the Channel 9 commentary. I don't think this is something you hear raised as a concern by the ABC team, to be honest. When I've listened to them, they haven't really complained about the rotation policy.
They haven't talked about it at all. You know why? Because they're not idiots. Good. They've got some great analysis. I find them incredibly intellectual. And they're not the biggest names in cricket. I mean, they don't just employ the next stud. There are rumours that Ricky Ponting is going to be the next one to join the Channel 9. God. Why? Because he used to play.
Yeah, that's the Australian way. All right, moving things back towards cricket, Kirk. One, seeing as you are on a roll, you're fired up. Look, can you try and take a stab at the holy grail of Australian cricket questions right now? So people our age, who are realistically our generation, are currently the generation that should be pulling the heavy lifting in a national sports team, that they should be hitting their straps. We grew up watching the greatest spin bowler in the history of cricket. I don't really think there's an argument there. How come this wasn't inspiring a generation of test spinners? Where is everybody? Why hasn't Shane Warne produced the greatest generation of spin bowlers Australia's ever seen?
Well, the big issue is that Australia is not spin friendly, Eric. It's very hard to bowl spin in Australia. Even Muralitharan came down here and struggled big time. Graham Swan comes down and struggles. The pitches just aren't conducive, and the conditions aren't conducive to spin, unless you're in Sydney. But even then, they're not making the minefields that they used to. It's a pace bowling country, and we don't even. Australia struggles to swing the ball. It's almost a geographical thing. I mean, New Zealand doesn't have great rip roaring fast bowlers because the pitches allow you just to bowl seam. You just got to land it in the right spot and the ball would eventually seam away. But you come over to Australia and that doesn't work because you don't have enough pace. You go to India and it doesn't work because there's no bounce or pace. And so it's almost a geographical thing. Australia's conditions aren't conducive to spin bowlers. So eventually you just get hit out of, you just get belted.
Yeah. So does that suggest that Shane Warne was even more exceptional in what he achieved?
It shows how incredible he was. The fact that he played so many of his games in Australia. You put him in the subcontinent. If he was Indian, I'd hate to think he'd be up over 1,000 wickets. I mean, if he did what Muralitharan did and played Bangladesh every second week, think how many wickets he would have got. But that just shows you how much more remarkable what Shane Warne did. So it's not that we don't have a good crop of spin bowlers coming through. It's just Australia is not conducive to spin.
Okay, good. I like it. That's insightful. Going deep. And I think that's a good place to finish this podcast on. I'm always happy to finish a podcast on some Shane Warne love. So, yeah, we will be back next week with another episode of the Sports Polygamy Podcast. It'll be Kirk and myself breaking down the championship games. I don't think we'll be looking forward to the Super Bowl just yet, but we'll have plenty to talk about the tennis by that point. Until then, you can follow this podcast at sportspolygamy.com. You can also find us on Facebook and on iTunes, where you can subscribe to keep track. Please leave a comment. If you've got any feedback, we'd love to hear it. Just stick it on the Facebook page or on the blog. Until next week, I'm Eric George.
I'm Kirk Dalziel.
And that's Sports Polygamy. See ya.